My name's Mary Kate, and I'm a storyteller, and so are you. Storytelling is a creative gift that, unlike others, is given to every single one of us. We can't all sing, we can't all paint, we can't all dance ballet, but not only can we all tell stories, we must. Storytelling is something that human beings do all day, every day, inside our own heads, even if we don't open our mouths and tell our stories to other people. And stories are the focus of all of my studies and have been at the heart of all my meaningful work. I've been a journalist and I've been a playwright and I've worked in film and television and written short stories. And sometimes when I'm interviewed about my work, I say stories are the central preoccupation of my life. But I realized when I was preparing this address, that's not strictly true. The central preoccupation of my life is seeking the divine or seeking a connection with the divine. I've always believed in God. I remember one time as a thought experiment, I tried not believing in God and it didn't work for me. But there was a long period in my life where I didn't think that God believed in me. And stories brought me back to a relationship with what we can call the source of all that is, or our Heavenly Mother and Father, but we can call it God too. Because my obsession with stories revealed a pattern which I now cannot but see as a design of the divine. But I also have known for a long time, as you do too, that stories have deep, mystical, magical power. I'll give you one demonstration. When I was in college, I loved an American kind of hippie writer called Tom Robbins, and there's a refrain in one of his books, which is, "It's never too late to have a happy childhood." And I thought that was beautiful and poetic. And I used to write it on notebooks and at the end of love notes to my tortured boyfriend in college. I didn't really understand what it meant until I met a woman who told me this story. And in brief, she said, "You know, I was the only child of quite elderly parents. So they were very strict, you know, and they always made sure that, like, there was, like, a meal on the table and I was sensibly dressed and that I got a good education, that I went to a good school and, you know, they always did my stood over me doing my homework. But she said they never showed me any affection. Like, they hardly ever touched me and they never called me by endearments. And I would go to my friends' houses and I would see them with their parents who were 20 years younger than mine, and their parents would get down on the floor and play with them and laugh with them and take them on their lap and tickle them and, like, put them in bed with them and call them by pet names." And she was like, why do their parents love them and my parents don't love me?" And she said, "You know, I grew quite cold in my feelings towards my parents." And she said, It was only when I was much older, towards the end of their lives, that I could look back and see my parents' entire lives since I was born had been an act of love for me. They were entirely focused on me. They were always there. They always made sure that I got the best nourishment I could. They wanted me to have an education. And that's why they cared so much about homework. And they paid for me to go to the best of schools. And actually, because of them and their beliefs in me, I got to go to university, which was unusual for a woman my age. And she said, "You know, well into my own middle age, I realized that my parents had loved me very, very much. They just had a different way of showing it than other people's parents." And I said to her, "It wasn't too late for you to have a happy childhood, was it?" And I really understood in that moment. I think that's what Tom Robbins meant, that, like, when we tell a story, we pick out of the apparently random universe, or certainly the apparently random events that are happening in our lives, we select certain parts of it And then we bring them all together. And when we've found the truth at the heart of a story, they become a harmonious whole. And that kind of feels divine to me, like an echo of creation. And one of the things I've noticed is if I have a story that I keep telling with a kind of urgency because I can't find the end of it, and sometimes, you know, particularly when I'm in Los Angeles where there's a lot of homelessness, you see people on the street and they're telling themselves a story and they've gone mad telling themselves this story because they can't find the end of it. It's because they haven't found the meaning of this story. So like storytelling is actually an attempt to wrest some meaning out of our lives. And I think that's why it's an act that echoes the divine, but also a beautiful creative act that can give us faith. I said I went through this period in my life where I didn't believe that or I didn't think that God believed in me. I don't know that I consciously had that thought, because if I'd consciously had the thought, I would have realized how ridiculous that was. But how I felt was that I had become unworthy and I'd turned away from God's love. But these days I pray every morning to be God aligned in my thoughts and then in my words and actions. I don't want to suggest for a minute that I succeed, but it's my prayer. And one of the things that I think about is that the divine does not want anything. How could infinite love want anything, to get anything from the universe? The divine only has gifts to offer. And I can vacillate between fear and faith all day long and my whole life. But like when I'm in fear, it does not bring out the best of me. When I am in faith, I am able to echo the attitude of infinite love, which is, what do I have to offer here? What am I bringing to the party? Can I be of any help here? How can I serve other and this universe? So when I remember that if I'm in fear, it's because I'm in the middle of a story and I can't see the ending yet, but I do believe that there is a pattern, there is a design in the divine, and I can go with the flow a little bit more than I ever could. And all stories effectively have the same shape. There might be some exceptions, but they're rare. The shape of every story that I've learned from my studies goes like this. Somebody's living their ordinary life, and then the status quo gets upset. So as long as I'm living my life and everything's going fine, good for me, but there's no story to tell. It's like you'll meet me and say, how are you? And I'll go, I'm good, everything's good, right? A story only arises when things stop going well. That in itself is a comfort. But the middle part of a story is when I decide I can see the future and I don't like how it looks. I'm going to try to change this future. I'm going to try and impose my will on the world. And it's really important to me to say about stories, that's a good moment. And I do believe that these desires to take some control, to stand up, to take a stand in our own lives are divinely implanted. And we should look out for them and we should welcome them. But the middle part of a story is always struggle. It's always pain. It's always difficulty. It's always challenges. And if it wasn't, it wouldn't be a story, right? If I was just like, I was poor and I decided to be rich and I bought a lottery ticket and I won, boom. Well, hooray for me, but it wasn't much of a story, right? You know, the story is where the struggle happens. The story is where my desire to achieve something in my life, to change the course of events, bumps up against the way life is going. And my persistence meets resistance. But because I have this intense desire, I keep going. But the part that I find so interesting is that a story doesn't end when somebody does or doesn't get their desire. that's only the end of the middle of the story. There's always a twist, and the story isn't over until we discover what the gift was. And the gift is always something that was inside us. Maybe it was a seed inside us, but it grew because of the struggle that we went through. Or another way of thinking about it for me is, the middle of a story is always what I want from the world. And that might be something noble. I might want to build houses in Africa, or I might want to become a better educated person. It might be something natural and good, like I want to find love. But it's still about me wanting something from the world. But the story isn't over until I discover what the world wanted from me. And that's where the meaning comes from. And that's why when I feel like I've struggled in vain, or something has happened in my world or anyone's world that seems pointless or meaningless, I find it a great solace to say, the story isn't over yet. Because we will know when the story is over, because it will make sense to us. So I'm going to tell you a story from my own life now that I hope will be an illustration of all of this, and I hope it will be an inspiration to you to know that the story of your life is 100% the design of the divine, and in its own time it will reveal its gifts. So a number of years ago, I opened my mouth and nothing came out. This had kept happening to me. I kept losing my voice. And I went to an ear, nose and throat specialist. And I said, help me. You have to help me. I can't go around whispering all the time. And he said, you absolutely must not go around whispering. He said, you have terrible abrasion on your vocal cords. And the worst thing you can do in that situation is to whisper. So he said, I'm putting you on complete voice rest. But in the meantime, he said, there's not much we can do for you. The reason you have this abrasion on your vocal cords is you're holding a great deal of tension in your throat. So I'm going to send you to a speech therapist who will teach you how to relax that tension in your throat and how to speak without putting pressure on your vocal cords. So I was 24 and I was mute on doctor's orders. I don't know if you've ever tried to live your life without your voice, but it's not an easy thing to do. I couldn't do my all-time favorite thing, which was chatting, and I couldn't do my job, and I couldn't do ordinary things like buy a train ticket or go into a shop. I had to have a little notebook and pen like your woman from the piano just to perform ordinary tasks. But after a couple of weeks, I got to go and see this speech therapist, and she took one look at my name on the intake form. This was in London, and she went, Mary Kate O'Flanagan, convent girl? And I went, and she said, yeah, I see a lot of you. She said, you know, the nuns do a good job of teaching you beautiful manners, but they also teach you to suppress your voice rather than say something that could upset other people. So then she said, this is a strange question, but do you mind if I ask you, are you a survivor? And I thought that was a weird question, but I'll be honest with you, if the conversation's about me, I'll follow wherever it's going. So I wrote in my little notebook, I like to think so. And she said, no, you haven't understood what I'm asking you. I'm asking you, are you a survivor? So once I understood what she meant, there was no need for me to write anything. She could read it all over me. And she said, yeah, yeah. And she said, I see a lot of that too. And she said, here's the thing. Your voice is really closely linked with emotions. So I can give you these exercises to do and your voice will come back. But unless you get some therapy, I promise you this is going to keep happening. So I left her office and I thought, oh, I do not want to go to therapy. I don't want to shine a light on the dark things inside me. But I was pretty sure that the unspeakable thing that was caught in my throat was also the reason that I had a disastrous and chaotic love life. And I didn't want that. So I decided to go to therapy. So now, I don't know if you've ever done talk therapy, but it's a long and slow process, especially if the reason you're going is because you can't talk. And after a couple of years, I found myself lamenting to this friend of mine that I couldn't see any measurable progress. And she said to me, "Oh, honey, that's because you're trying to heal your soul. You can't heal your soul with just talk therapy." And I said, how do you heal your soul? And she said, "For you, I would recommend Reiki." So I went along to a Reiki healer and I handed over £50 and I lay on a plinth while this woman ran her hands in the air above my body. And I thought, okay, I'm one of these people now. I kept flashing back to when my sisters and I had laughed ourselves silly because a friend of ours had paid to have her aura massaged. And I was like, I don't know how this is any different. But when I left there, I was suffused with this undeniable feeling of well-being. And I thought, something's happened. So I started going to Reiki regularly. And then Reiki led to reflexology. And then reflexology led to acupuncture. And I attended acupuncture in a holistic health center. And I found myself in this holistic health center standing in front of a cork board with all these flyers and cards for lots of wild and wonderful healing modalities. And as time went on, I was still living kind of what looked like a sort of conservative life. Like I would go to work in an office wearing a suit and carrying a briefcase. But I was also spending more and more of my spare time and my spare cash going to drumming circles and tree hugging ceremonies and fasting and yoga retreats. And eventually I found myself at sometimes my two lives would collide. One time I was driving around with my sisters and whatever we were talking about, I said, "Well, my rebirther says that," and my sister Rachel said, "Pause." She was like, "I'm sorry, we'll get to the rest of that sentence in a minute, but let's unpack this first. You have a rebirther?" But eventually I found myself at a week-long residential workshop based on the amazing work of the wonderful Louise Hay, the book called You Can Heal Your Life, and this was a week-long workshop of that. And I was paired up with one other woman during this week for a particular exercise, and I said to her, "You know what? I've been at this crack for decades. I wish I could just be fixed." And she said, why do you think you need to be fixed? And I said, "Because where is he? Like, where is he? If I was fixed, then I'd be able to have a happy romantic relationship that lasted more than a couple of months." And she said, "What if your life is exactly the way it's supposed to be?" And I thought about that for a minute. And then I saw with a clang of clarity that if I got what I wanted when I was 24, to meet someone and fall in love and live happily ever after, I might not have seen the sunrise on a beach in Thailand while I was doing yoga. I might not have got to wrap my arms around the baobab trees in the Okavango Delta of Botswana. And I might not have felt bliss at the top of the Boboli Gardens in Florence after climbing up there on my own. And I thought, I wouldn't have met the other people who turn up in parish halls and community centres and yurts and fields. The other people who feel like maybe they're a bit bockety and a bit broken. But the people who keep turning their faces to the sunlight of the spirit. The people who keep the faith that regardless of the wreckage of the past, tomorrow could be better. I love those people. They're my people. And I don't think I would have had a chance to develop what might be my superpower, which is making friends. And in that moment, I saw my life like a pearl grown up around a grain of sand, beautiful because of my ancient scar and not despite it. And I saw that there was nothing about it and nothing about me that needed to be fixed. And I know that was true because a couple of years later, I got chatting to a nun at a luggage carousel in Copenhagen Airport. I love nuns and I stalk them. And as I was chatting to her, I realised that she was this famous nun, like not just famous in Catholic circles, but famous in woo-woo circles, because she is a bona fide faith healer with a number of miracles to her name. And I didn't ask her to lay her hands on me. I didn't want anything from her. I just asked her about herself and her travels and her own spiritual journey. So it was kind of a surprise when we were parting. And she took from out of the pocket of her robes a little turquoise beaded bracelet. And she slipped it onto my wrist. And she said, "I'm a matchmaker too, you know." And I thought, what a strange thing to say to a middle-aged woman. Especially because for decades, I've employed the old trick of the female solo traveler, which is to wear a ring on your wedding finger, gives the impression of a male protector about to appear. But then he did appear. A tall, dark, handsome man who'd been in my orbit for a while took me by the hand and then took me into his arms and said, "Will we give it a go?" And I thought, I don't believe it. After all the shamanic guides and the voodoo priestesses and the rebirthing breath coaches, it was a good old-fashioned Irish nun who broke the spell and brought me to my true love. But here's the thing. As much as I've appreciated that man's presence in my life and treasured the love that we share, he is not the gift of this story. The gift of this story is that somewhere along that long and winding road, I found my voice. Thank you.